From the Emory Wheel, I'm Gabriella Lewis. This is Wheel Talk. In a year of uncertainty and reflection, art is what helped us get through 2020. From new movie releases on streaming services, to looking back at old favorites of TV, to a myriad of quarantine tunes, 2020 brought us plenty of art gems. We break down with our arts and entertainment writers most influential movies, television, music, and Emory art from this year. Okay. Hi, Saru.
Hey.
So can you introduce yourself and kind of talk about what you've been writing for the past year in the world of film and television?
So I'm the arts and entertainment editor for The Wheel, and I've been taking a look at film and television over the course of 2020. I do a lot of watching in my free time. So yeah, I've been just taking a look at, you know, what some of the best stuff is that's come out.
The weirdness of this year and the difference of this year is apparent in when you look at the film and television. Not only were we in quarantine for a lot of the year, surviving a global pandemic with thousands and thousands of lives lost, but we are also having a racial reckoning. I think the film and television that we saw this year really reflected a lot of that. So we're going to break down some of the best, the most influential pieces of film and television of the year. We're going to start with film. And we're going to start with Nomadland, which was a film that came out and was directed by Chloe Zhao.
Nomadland was a release that it hasn't actually had a wide release yet. So I was very lucky to catch it online. I got a rental of it. And it basically follows this group of older Americans who find that they're out of work and Social Security is not enough to get them by. So they begin living in RVs and vans, and they travel around the country and look for work. And, you know, this movie really struck me. I think it's the best of the year, in my opinion. Frances McDormand plays this lead actor, or this lead character, and I definitely think that she is a contender for Best Actress. She has built her career off of playing these very quintessentially American characters, you know, in Three Billboards, in Fargo, and I think that her character in this movie is no different. And something that has happened as a result of the pandemic, with production being shut down and all these big budget movies where theater or, you know, companies are very invested in getting their money back, it means that it's been a really big year for independent films and independent filmmakers like Chloe Zhao. So I think Nomadland has a real chance to shine, and it's time for her to get some recognition.
Systemic racism is in no way a new concept. And Five Bloods, which is Spike Lee's most recent movie, really discusses the Black experience starting in the Vietnam War and kind of what being Black in America is.
So it very coincidentally coincided with this racial reckoning and all these protests that happened in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. Those protests started around late May, and the movie came out in the middle of June when they were still well underway. You know, Spike Lee is basically interested in paralleling the Black experience in America with the larger experience of America in the Vietnam War. And it seems as though he's asserting to an extent that to be Black in America is to constantly be at war. I was very moved by it. I found it to be a very powerful comparison to make. So one of the stars of the film is Delroy Lindo. And as of right now, I think he's probably my pick for Best Actor. He depicts PTSD with such care. There's a monologue that he delivers near the end of the movie that just is absolutely mind-blowing, and I think completely justifies any award that he can, will, and should get. In addition to him, this movie had Chadwick Boseman's penultimate role, and it's very interesting, and it takes on an additional kind of poignancy because he plays a deceased member of these Black veterans group. His legacy really informs their action, and they're always thinking about him. And so kind of him having, you know, the question of his legacy was already here before his passing even occurred.
Tenet, which is our last film, was one of the only films during the pandemic that was, you know, since March, that was actually released in theaters, directed by Christopher Nolan, who really wanted that theatrical release, even though obviously that was not the norm of this year. Can you tell us a little bit about Tenet, the movie? Obviously, it got a ton of buzz.
Tenet was kind of framed or positioned both by, I think, the studio and by Christopher Nolan as the blockbuster that was going to save movie theaters. Because even prior to its release, theaters had been struggling. They'd been shut down. Attendance was dwindling next to nothing. And, you know, Tenet has a lot of these hallmarks that Christopher Nolan is known for, the action movies are known for, these, you know, really big set pieces, big budget, special effects, big name actors. And so there was kind of the sense that if anything is going to draw in the crowds, it'll be this movie. And unfortunately, it was not a successful rollout, to the point where Warner Brothers has made the decision that their entire 2021 slate, including really highly anticipated blockbuster films like Dune, is going to be on HBO Max. They're still going to have a theatrical release, but simultaneously, the same day, they will put these movies on streaming.
This is a piece of history right here, right? Like, from, you know, the beginning of movies, people have watched them in movie theaters, and movie theaters hold a lot of emotional weight to people, and not saying that movie theaters are going to disappear off the face of the earth and, you know, this next year completely, but it's going to be dwindled. It's going to be somewhat a thing of the past with this decision. What are we potentially losing?
Going to theater to see a movie is a very communal experience. Personally, I'm a big fan of movie theaters, and it's one of the kind of institutions that I've missed the most, being in lockdown. And I think that it's kind of this communal catharsis, and it's a way that everybody comes together and feels the same emotions together, which really, you know, heightens all those feelings that you have. There's something very special about kind of watching a movie all together with friends, families, and also strangers, and then kind of stumbling out from the darkness, feeling like you're a brand new person. And so, of course, it makes it all that more difficult and emotional to know that, you know, this might be the end, although I am holding on to hope that they will be able to come back from this.
The streaming and binging that has kind of become what television is thought of this day and age really got through people through the pandemic. And I think there was some new releases that came out, as well as also some old favorites that people went back to that we're going to discuss, that really were the sense of comfort that got people through potentially one of the weirdest years in the world's history. To illustrate the bizarrety of this year really well is Tiger King. So Tiger King follows this man named Joe Exotic, who had a large property in Oklahoma where he had lots of tigers, and created this like world where people could come see them and whatnot. And then there's this other character, Carol Baskin, who has like a tiger sanctuary down in Florida. And it was this really enthralling series discussing the world of exotic animals. And it had these huge implications.
There is a weird sense of comfort when the world seems so bizarre to see something that's just even crazier than what you're going through. Makes you feel a little more normal, a little more grounded. And I think if there's one movie or TV show that provided that to people this year, it would be Tiger King, hands down. I think something that was special about this show was, you know, going back to what I said about movie theaters, there's something where you can all feel and experience whatever, this piece of art together. And even though we all felt very separated and isolated from one another at the beginning of the pandemic, Tiger King was this cultural point of connection because everybody was watching it and everyone was talking about it. It was kind of the closest thing that we could get to a communal experience.
Another TV show that really exemplified that was The Last Dance. I think this has got to be my favorite TV show that came out this year. The Last Dance really showed the Chicago Bulls in the 1990s and kind of the dominance of that team. I'm a basketball fan, so this was really fun to watch. And it was another kind of big quarantine pastime, as well as also, you know, there was largely no sports this year. So again, kind of a sense of escapism. Can you tell us a little bit more about The Last Dance? I know you're from Chicago, Saru, so it probably meant something to you as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely something nostalgic. Not exactly for me. I was not around in the 1990s, but, you know, for my family members who were here in the 1990s, kind of reliving those glory years of this team. You know, my family would tune in every weekday night that it was on and watch it all together. You know, there's something so consuming about this year that makes you wonder, if there's ever been life outside of this, makes you forget that you ever, you know, left your house and saw your friends or went to big events like sporting, like, you know, like basketball games. And so it there was an odd sense of comfort in watching The Last Dance and remembering, you know, there'd be these big crowds of people that would congregate and watch basketball. And there was a time before this, and, you know, hopefully there will be a time after this.
I think what you're getting at is nostalgia was really the heart of The Last Dance. And it was a new release, but it was nostalgic. And that kind of brings us into our more like last category of television. Of this year was about nostalgia. There was totally new releases that came out kind of that we've highlighted. But for me, this was a year where I went back to my favorites. One of those was Avatar, The Last Airbender, and it was re-released on Netflix. And people really went back to it and binge watched it.
There's something comforting about seeing these characters and these stories that you recall. There's something nice about watching something where you know what the outcome is and then you know how it ends, especially in a year where there's been so much uncertainty. It's very fantastical, again, with this idea of seeing worlds that aren't our own, which also made it special. I think a lot of us are home with our families for the longest period of time that we have been in a while, or for the first time in a long while. So that kind of childhood nostalgia, that transportation to like the feeling of being young, is especially hard hitting and especially made Avatar something worth rewatching.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, what's up?
Not much. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been kind of covering for this past year in terms of music?
I'm Jeffrey Rosen. I'm a sophomore currently at Emory, and I've been writing about music. And so today I'm here with some of the most important albums of the year.
We're going to start things off with the Tame Impala album, The Slow Rush. Kevin Parker, who is Tame Impala, somewhat more mainstream, and kind of gives the name for indie music. So can you tell us a little bit more about this album and kind of what it meant to the world?
After 2015, and when he dropped Currents, people were waiting very eagerly for his next release. Currents kind of just kept building more and more popularity, kind of blew him up, kind of being like the biggest name, the most recognizable dude in like the indie psych scene. So with The Slow Rush, it was kind of his transition into being like this fully pop indie music. He kind of advanced his sound from the more psych disco of Currents to a more post disco. It's kind of these slowed down grooves, long multi-section songs, just using a lot of vintage synthesizers and old electronics, combining that with newer pop sensibilities. I really think his songwriting is just completely progressed forward and advanced for the better with this album.
Tame Impala has really brought indie now into the mainstream, and part of that is kind of with Spotify and how artists are on these streaming platforms and advertised. Can you tell us a little bit more about the curation of things on Spotify?
Absolutely. So I definitely think you can look at The Slow Rush as a kind of a primary source for how indie music is being pushed at new popular music. So you can look at curators specifically from Spotify like Pollen and Lorem, and how influential they are at bringing less popular subgenres within indie and alternative music to the mainstream, and it makes it much more easily accessible to daily listeners who don't necessarily have the time to deeply search for all these like cutting edge artists.
Going off of that, Jeffrey, you know, there's indie music and indie music that's becoming the mainstream. And then there's kind of the flip side of that. Someone like Taylor Swift, who has been in the game for so long. We think of her as, you know, first country and then pop. And now she's kind of bringing it into indie music with Folklore and Evermore, her two albums that came out this year. She had, Bon Iver on that and other kind of more indie artists that aren't as much as like the pop music that we think of with Taylor Swift. Can you kind of tell us more about how Taylor Swift dominated this year with her move to indie music?
It's been really interesting to hear Folklore and Evermore this year, kind of a shift towards more indie and alternative music, especially considering how the past decade she was making basically just straight pop music. So now with Folklore and especially Evermore, she's kind of reaching out into this weird, folky, quiet, rustic atmosphere, really playing into like the quiet indie vibes. I really liked Evermore a lot. It really was kind of a nice, quiet fall listen, especially with quarantine. I think it's been really interesting how music fits the quarantine, you know, the how it is to just be inside or to go on a walk by yourself. I think these are two great albums for quarantine.
She's changed in a lot of ways and become this artist that's, you know, obviously she knows how to transcend genre over her career in a way that very few do.
And she walks the line in a very gentle and precise way of making sure that it's still incredibly, you know, accessible and has popular appeal. You know, she's kind of the master of that.
Let's talk about hip hop this year. So Alfredo, which was Freddie Gibbs, who's kind of a newer artist who kind of pays homage to old school hip hop.
Over the past couple of years, Freddie has really like solidified himself as being able to do anything in rap. He raps over crazy Kenny Beats trap beats, but also some of the, like the soulful jazzy Madlib beats. He's kind of like Andre 3000 from Outkast to me, where he just kind of has this really smooth, sensual tone. So this year, when he's collaborating with The Alchemist, who fills this album with just these really soulful, jazzy beats, effortlessly walking all over them at this peak of his game. There's also just great features all over this album. There's Tyler the Creator, there's Benny the Butcher, Rick Ross has an amazing feature. You know, some of my favorite songs are Scotty Beam, Something to Rap About, and God is Perfect.
So you can't talk about 2020 without talking about Megan Thee Stallion and her album Suga. Also, just the dominance of Black women in the music field this year. It was an incredible year for Megan Thee Stallion. She's probably the biggest rapper of the year. She's nominated for Best New Artist. She had banger after banger off Suga and off of kind of her other stuff of this year. So let's talk about who she is in general this year for Black women in hip hop.
Yeah, so Suga just totally exploded this year. Megan came out with viral hit after viral hit, you know, Savage, Captain Hook. My Phone from this album is amazing. Suga just blends kind of these like this old school kind of Midwest trap with contemporary trap in such a cool, interesting way. And then her aggressive flow over these beats is just so fun, playful, infectious. It's like you can't get enough of listening to it. And that's why I think a big part of which is why people are addicted to Megan this year. Of course, she also had probably the biggest song this year, WAP with Cardi B. Also, one of the things that's really interesting about this album is that it might be one of the first TikTok albums. There's so many songs in this album that were just massive on TikTok. You couldn't use and not hear Megan Thee Stallion everywhere. It's also just this idea that songs that are massive on TikTok are also just the number one songs on Billboard. You know, I don't really listen to the radio that often, but the few times that I do, all of the songs on there are just TikTok songs. You know, so so TikTok and social media is now kind of dictating what are the popular songs. And it's kind of a shift in influencing what is popular in music. And, you know, Megan is kind of just the central figure to this whole new music scene that's drifting towards social media.
And beyond just TikTok, she's the embodiment of 2020 in a lot of different ways. You know, 2020 was not only a big year because of coronavirus, obviously, and also the racial reckoning that we had in this country with the Black Lives Matter movement. And Megan Thee Stallion was absolutely a part of that. In October, she wrote in the New York Times, Why I Speak Up for Black Women, as well as also went on SNL and discussed kind of the same topic after Breonna Taylor was murdered. As much as Meg Thee Stallion was an incredible part of this year, we would be remiss to not talk about the other women in hip hop, and specifically the Black women in hip hop this year, and just Black women in general who have really pushed this year to what it is, and the absolutely incredible music that has come out of it. We got a Flo Milli album, we had a Rico Nasty album, we had music from No Name. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of these really incredible albums?
Sure. So Rico Nasty, Emory alum, not really, but he played at a McDonough Field. She's coming out with another great album. I really liked, she kind of, you know, taking a lot of hyperpop influences on. There's Dylan Brady production, which is, you know, for the 100 Gex fans out there, I guess they'll probably like that. I like the aggressive and electronic feel to a lot of this stuff. But yeah, so Song 33 by No Name was one of my like favorite rap songs of the year for sure. You know, Madlib beat, No Name just absolutely spitting over the beat. Quick, it's tight, but it's very potent. When the Black Lives Matter protest kind of started, J. Cole released a song where he was criticizing a vague artist and not using their social media to support Black Lives Matter. But most people interpreted this as being a direct shot at No Name for not using her social media. So she released the song, Song 33, in which she kind of, you know, criticizes J. Cole for directing his anger at her, and then brilliantly lays out the whole situation and kind of shows the scene kind of lays out the landscape of America right now. Also, of course, it's worth mentioning a historic year, you know, for Black women in rap. There was four Black women artists in the top on the top songs of the chart with Say So by Doja Cat and Nicki Minaj. And then also Savage, which, of course, is a TikTok song. Megan, but with Beyonce. So it's just, you know, Black women in rap just solidifying their presence.
Hi, Zimra. So you've been looking at Emory art pretty extensively. Can you tell me who you are and what you've been up to these past couple of months?
Yeah, this past semester was actually my first semester as a writer for the Emory Wheel. I'm a contributing writer for the arts and entertainment section, as I'm a huge fan of visual art, so I really got to explore that as a writer there. And also, being on campus this semester, I really got to explore the Emory arts scene.
So obviously this has been a really different year for art, visually, music, movies, TV, like we've kind of discussed throughout this podcast. But it's been especially weird for visual art because, you know, people go to museums for the vast majority of the time, or they go to concert halls, or they go to theaters, and that's just not feasible in 2020. And I think we've seen new creative ways of bringing art, both on kind of an institutional level, but then also at a more casual student level. So we're going to break down kind of the best, most influential pieces that have happened at Emory, and kind of, you know, how they've connected to the larger world. And the first one we want to talk about is the Inhaler art exhibit. Someone left their inhaler right outside of the DCT, and students kind of ran with that. And they created an art exhibit. They created a little label about what it was like. And it was kind of this fun community building. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite articles to write. It spoke to, you know, the creative ways that students really did get to collaborate with each other and get to know each other on campus, despite the lack of in-person events and opportunities because of COVID. Yeah, it started out in a GroupMe chat called Real Eagles Only. And somebody, yeah, they just posted the inhaler so that, you know, whoever lost it would find it, but it just sat there for weeks and weeks, and then somebody suggested to turn it into an art exhibit, and Emory students sure did. And I just think that it was such a fantastic and creative way to kind of create this running joke that we all had together. And it was, I thought it was an interesting interpretation of kind of ephemeral art, you know, art that is very popular nowadays are things that, you know, don't necessarily last, but the experience and the moment of the art is the most important. It reminded me actually of that Banksy artwork that was sold, and as soon as it was purchased, it was shredded. Because the inhaler was eventually taken down, and it was mourned in the group chat that the gallery had been removed, but, you know, I think that was part of the experience. We knew it would be short, but we knew it was also like, a special way for everybody to bond together through humor and art.
Going off of, you know, something that's very specific to Emory, the Emory Drag Show is an annual tradition here at Emory. I was lucky enough to go last year, kind of pre-pandemic, and it's this really beautiful celebration that's held in a chapel, actually, of not only just like celebration and community, but also of the LGBTQ community, an incredibly important facet of Emory. But, you know, this year they couldn't have it in the chapel. They had to, you know, bring that online. Can you tell us a little bit about how they adapted it?
Yeah, it was definitely a lot more complicated this year. I spoke to some of the Emory Pride organizers, and they talked about how the process was a lot more messy this year, figuring out how to transition it to Zoom. Because being in a drag performance and that experience is often very, you know, physically immersive. So it was definitely something that was difficult to adapt, but I personally thought they did a very successful job of that. They really allowed each drag queen to shine because they pre-recorded all of the performances and then they played them over Zoom. They really adapted that well. And when I was talking to the Emory Pride Board, they did say that they felt the performance didn't necessarily create a community as it usually does because, you know, everybody's in that physical space, it draws a really large crowd, but they did feel that it helped to reinforce the community that was already there.
prides were canceled all across the country, at least in person this year. And so that space of being able to be yourself and being able to really celebrate, I think a lot of people were robbed of this year, and an incredibly emotionally hurtful year, quite honestly. And so I think them persevering and creating this drag show and creating community or reinforcing it is a testament to how Emory Art prevailed. So the next thing we're going to talk about is music. Music is a really large part of Emory. There's tons of music majors and a lot of people who are really, really passionate about playing music. And a big thing that happened this year was the Schwartz Center virtual stage. Can you tell us about that? I know you covered it pretty closely.
So the Schwartz Center virtual stage is essentially their platform in a non-physical format to highlight the same artists that they would usually highlight in their physical concerts. And they have continuous events that are live streamed or pre-recorded to show up on the virtual stage. I was honestly impressed by all of them. They were such a nice break in my dorm room to, you know, feel like you're in a concert even though you're sitting in the same chair you've been sitting in all day. And, you know, it was also kind of nice because nobody was there, so you could dance around to the music as well in your own space.
Finally, of kind of our last pieces of influential art at Emory was the Carlos Museum, and still were up and running for students in the Atlanta area. So some of the things that they did was a discussion of the book The Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory, which was written by Claudio Sant. And it's a really important book because it talks about indigenous art and, you know, kind of restitution and the way that the art history community has somewhat abused indigenous people, as well as also looted and taken indigenous art.
The Carlos Museum is actually very diligent about making sure their objects don't have a history of, you know, colonialism and looting. So they do a lot of research to make sure they don't. I attended the discussion of Unworthy Republic. First of all, it's just very cool to be able to talk to the author of such an impactful book. And most of the discussion was just him really educating the audience about the topics addressed in the book. So he covered a lot of issues concerning histories of Native American displacement and the impacts of that historical violence. And then he was also introduced by Craig Womack, who's an associate professor of English at Emory. And they both kind of talked to each other about this research on Native American displacement and violence throughout history. And it was very timely as well, because I believe the event occurred a couple or a few days before Columbus Day. So it was a really great way to, you know, actually acknowledge the violence of that history instead of glorifying it.
In a year that threw countless challenges, art, both on and off Emory's campus, was something to be grateful for. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Wheel Talk. Listen and subscribe to Wheel Talk at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you usually get your podcasts. Wheel Talk is produced by Gabriella Lewis, Kaylin Chin, Isaiah Poritz, and Madison Bober. Music by Kevin McLeod, and cover art by Kaylin Chin.